On 88 Wild, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Today, we continue our series of conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore City. Nick Mosby joins me in Studio A. In 2011, he was elected to represent the 7th District on the Baltimore City Council. Last spring, he and his wife, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby, garnered national attention during the unrest following the death of Freddie Gray. Now he has entered a crowded race for mayor. I'll ask Nick Mosby about his vision for the city. Then, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has issued a new set of dietary guidelines. Think about that. Is the Department of Agriculture, which regulates the meat and dairy industry, for example, the best agency to suggest guidelines about how much meat and dairy we should all eat? Our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, is here to help us sort it all out. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan's got the latest local news. We'll start with these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Hope you're getting dug out. Today, we continue our series of conversations with people who have announced their intention to run for mayor of Baltimore. As of today, 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans have registered with the Board of Elections to be on the April 26th primary ballot. 1 Green Party candidate, 2 independents, and 5 unaffiliated candidates have also registered for the general election. At least 4 candidates have opened campaign headquarters and have been actively campaigning but have yet to file with the Board of Elections. Their deadline to do so is next Wednesday. We're spending every Wednesday here on Maryland Morning speaking with candidates about their vision for the city. Today, my guest is Nick Mosby. He's a Democrat. He is several weeks away from his 36th birthday or 37th birthday? 37. All right, he's almost 37. He was born and raised here in Baltimore. He lives in Reservoir Hill with his wife, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby, and their 2 young daughters. He's a former senior project manager for BGE. He was also a network engineer with Verizon. In 2011, he was elected to represent the 7th District on the Baltimore City Council. Welcome, sir. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, you ran for city council once and didn't get it. You ran the second time and was elected. Full disclosure, you are my council representative. We are neighbors in Reservoir Hill. And by all reports, you're doing a great job representing the 7th District. This is a big risk, though. You have to resign that seat to run for mayor. So if you lose, you're out of politics, at least for a little while. What is so appealing? What is so attractive to you about the job of mayor of the city of Baltimore that would make you take this kind of risk?
Well, Tom, you know, I really enjoy being a public servant, specifically serving the residents of the 7th District. I absolutely love my job as councilman of the 7th District. I always talked about the 7th District as being a microcosm of the city of Baltimore. It has everything that's right about the city, but also everything that's going wrong with the city of Baltimore. You know, I've decided to put my name in the hat for mayor of Baltimore because right now this time is such a critical time in our city's history. And, you know, you think about what took place back in May. You think about some of the systemic issues that have plagued our communities for decades. Right now, more than ever, we need leadership with vision. And that's why, you know, I put forth this comprehensive plan. It's a 15-point plan called Connecting the Dots that really goes after some of the historic and structural and systemic issues that have plagued our communities for far too long. And, you know, I just think that I'm uniquely positioned, being born and raised in the city of Baltimore, doing well in corporate America, you know, having exposure inside of city government to really try to connect the dots and really try to get to some of the deficiencies in our city.
You've been on the council, you know, 5-6 years now. You were the main animator behind the Ban the Box legislation. Would you count that among your greatest achievements so far as a city council person? If not, what else?
Well, definitely Ban the Box. I mean, Ban the Box is the most progressive fair hiring policy in the country. We were able to do it right here in Baltimore City with a lot of opposition, but understanding and knowing that we have to go after recidivism. And Ban the Box is not the end-all be-all. It's one variable inside this very complex equation around recidivism. But it's an important component, and I was excited that my colleagues in the city of Baltimore got behind it. Other things that we've tackled.
I want to remind folks, by the way, that what this means is that employees, employers, when a person is applying for a job to an employer, he or she does not have to disclose a felony conviction until later in the process than before.
Correct. You know, it provides a fair playing field so you can sell yourself on your interpersonal skills and your background and your experience, as opposed to, you know, a lot of companies have like these vetted process where automatically when you check the box, your application is kind of vetted out.
Mm-hmm. You were widely applauded for being on the streets during the riots in April and the unrest that it happened in our district, in the 7th District. With your wife, Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, you've led dozens and dozens of Enough is Enough marches around West Baltimore. There is, however, this glacial pace of change in places like Sandtown and for families like Freddie Gray and his family. There are dozens of churches in Sandtown. There are dozens of nonprofits who are doing work in Sandtown. There have been millions of dollars invested in that one neighborhood around Pennsylvania, North Avenue, that area of town. As a mayor, how can you speed up this incredibly slow glacial pace, that's the only way I can describe it, of change and transformation for places like that?
When you look at an area like Sandtown and you talk about the millions of dollars from Enterprise to other nonprofits and organizations that have been poured in there, there's one root issue, and that's the huge concentration of poverty, specifically in Gilmore Homes. That is like the core of the neighborhood. You know, if we're going to be serious about changing communities like Gilmore around, Sandtown around, we have to be serious about tackling this concentration of poverty issue that persists throughout our city. And this isn't something that just happened, you know, but this was intentionally done through policy, through urban revitalization from 40 and 50 years ago. So to change Sandtown around, first, you really have to go after Gilmore Homes. You know, and that doesn't mean displacement of folks. There's so many vacant properties. There's so many opportunities for affordable housing in and around Sandtown. But really, the core of it having being Gilmore is a problem. I mean, what I would love to do is ultimately tear down Gilmore Homes, develop an area where you have workforce development, where you have small to medium manufacturing, where you have something that the community can really call an asset and opportunity for improvement. Again, not displacing residents, but really rooting the core of the community away from you know, this structural issue.
Would you do that with all of the public housing in Baltimore, or are you specifically citing Gilmore?
Well, I think Gilmore is a glaring example of the problem. You know, concentration of poverty has never worked. And this is not a West Baltimore thing. You go to East New York or North Philadelphia or the South Side of Chicago. It's everywhere in urban America. And again, it was intentionally done. I mean, you look at books like Not in My Neighborhood, and you look at the development of these communities over these past couple of decades. So
it's a book about redlining and real
estate. Yeah, redlining. And, yeah. So concentration of poverty, again, is a major issue in Baltimore City. And it must be something that we have to tackle. I mean, you know, we talk about the housing authority and we talk about housing community development. I mean, look at these communities. We haven't really seen much change over the past 15 or 20 years.
You've talked about, you know, Mr. Graziano's, he said that he should resign. Obviously, he won't last long in a Mosby administration. What are you looking for in the director of the housing authority in Baltimore City? What kind of person do you want in there? What could they be doing differently than Mr. Graziano's doing?
So I think that's very symbolic of this race. Like, you know, I keep telling folks that there's two clear choices. Either we can look at the first choice, which is business as usual, the things that we've been doing for the past 20 and 30 years, or we can try to really push the envelope and try to change the trajectory of our communities by coming after it with different perspectives. So, and I say that with Mr. Graziano. I mean, I have a huge amount of personal respect for him, but he's been there for 15 years. And when we look at the vacancies throughout the city of Baltimore, when we look at our communities throughout the city of Baltimore, we don't see that type of drastic improvement that we need to see. So, you know, in my 15-point plan, a comprehensive plan, again, I'm the only person that have put out exactly what I want to do. You can't walk from mayor, you have to run from mayor. And that's why we took a lot of time to pour into this document. And I ask folks, your listeners, to read it, the 15-point comprehensive plan. But we talk about bold districts. We talk about developing ways of leveraging our assets. I mean, you know, close to Sandtown, you have a metro stop. You have the historic
bold,
district.
Bold, by the way, is a building
off
on
of leverage
development. Yeah. Not B-O-L-D, right?
Yep. You have historic Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Avenue. You have institutions like Coppin and MICA. You have all these things, these assets that you really can kind of maximize the bang for your buck and do a good job where the folks, again, it's not about displacement, but it's about providing equity growth for all in the community. So, that's what I would tackle and that's what I would go after.
Let's talk about assets. Your plan calls for the creation of many new offices. You want to create a mayor's office of education reform, a city procurement office, the office of contract and project management, the office of data analysis, the mayor's office of returning citizens for folks coming out of prison. These are all new offices. Yet we're facing more fiscal austerity in this year. The mayor and the budget office have predicted a $75 million shortfall for the next fiscal year. Mayor Rawlings Blake has asked all city agencies to propose spending cuts of up to 5%.
Yeah.
I don't want to ask you, how you're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
But I want to say, when it comes to an efficient government, the size of our city government is about the same as it was when we had 1 million residents.
Yeah.
Now we have 600,000 residents.
Yeah.
And are you proposing, to add more people to this bureaucracy? And how does that help? Is there any other way to do it?
So, Tom, that's a great question. And I think you're exactly right. The government has remained the same, and we've kind of done things the same way. Under my proposal, we're talking about changing up and having a different perspective and outlook on it. I mean, we have a $3.2 billion budget. And in comparison to other cities that are much larger than us, per capita, that's a very large budget. It's about how you spend your dollar and spending it more efficiently. That's why, from government reform, we talk about importance of us doing financial and performance audits. We are, from a project management perspective, which is my background, I've managed $100 million projects with tons and tons of folks reporting to me. I know the importance of having certified project management professionals that are ensuring that projects are finishing on time and on cost. And that's simply not happening. You sit at a BOE hearing and you see jobs that come in at 20 and 30 and 40% cost overruns. We need to look at things from a schedule and performance index and cost performance index and really just get our biggest bang for our buck again. And today we're not doing that. So it's about efficiently spending our money.
So what in your mind, and we're going to take a little break for news and come back and talk much more about this, but how would you describe what would be the most radical departure of your way of governing, your countenance in this position than the current mayor or, for that matter, any of your opponents?
I would say leveraging a data-driven approach, looking at metrics, holding objectives, developing goals that not only will judge our performance inside City Hall, but the citizens can judge our performance. And you can't do that when you're not tracking this type of data. So that goes across the board. I mean, again, something as small as, are we finishing our projects on time? If we have a vendor that, has historically finished jobs 6 months after he was supposed to and, gone over, budget 30 and 40%, why are we still rewarding him with new work?
So part of the problem is that we don't know enough.
We don't have enough data. We're not keeping the data. We're not storing the data. And that's my background. I'm an electrical engineer. I've done capacity utilization for large telecommunications companies. I understand the importance of what data is and predictive analytics and how to leverage that data to drive improvements.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and today we're continuing our weekly series of conversations with candidates for mayor of the city of Baltimore. This morning, Democratic candidate Nick Mosby joins me. He is on the Baltimore City Council representing the 7th District. He is credited with, among other initiatives, passing the Ban the Box legislation in Baltimore City that allows ex-felons to disclose their conviction later in the hiring process when they apply for jobs. He is 36 years old. He's married to State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. They are the proud parents of two beautiful daughters who are almost as beautiful as my daughter was when she was their age. So welcome back, Mr. Mosby, and
thank you
for your time. Education is a big part of your 15-point plan. The first 3 points have to do with education.
Totally.
But what influence does the mayor have on the schools in the city of Baltimore, a control of which was given up to the state in return for a $254 million infusion of money back in the 90s, 1997. It was under the Schmoke administration. I mean, how can you steer the boat when it comes to the schools?
So, Tom, I think, unfortunately, we've played this game of semantics of ownership, like who owns the school system? But it's at the end of the day, we need to be accountable for the children in the school system. And it's true, the state puts in about 2 to 1 as it relates to the funding for our school system. And, this idea that we're going to take back control and ownership while still receiving that money in a Republican-led governorship probably is not right, right? It's not going to happen, right? At the end of the day, there's a fiduciary responsibility to everyone in the state to understand and know what's going on with Baltimore City schools. So this idea of ownership, again, is just not going to take place. So let's stop playing that game and let's talk about accountability. And the fact of the matter is City Hall needs to be more accountable to our most precious assets and resources, our youth. And if we don't have our thumbs on the pulse of the school system, understanding and knowing where the budget is, understanding and knowing how resources are dealt out, understanding and knowing the direction and the best and brightest and the practices that we can bring to the city of Baltimore, if we're not engaged in that, that's a problem. And right now, there's no one tied into that specifically at City Hall. So that's why, you know, I have offered up a mayor's office of educational reform. You know, in my 15-point plan, a comprehensive plan, you know, we talk about the importance of early childhood education and doing universal preschool with social impact bonding. We talk about the importance of getting, you know, third graders proficient in reading and the exponential growth that you see in graduation rates of City of Baltimore. We talk about that pipeline between third and ninth grade. We know where our vulnerable children are. And then lastly, we talk about the importance of really preparing them for workforce. And that's simply not happening. And for us to sit back and say, oh, we don't own the school system, so we can't do anything about it, it's just completely irresponsible and it's counterproductive to the growth of our city.
But knowing it is one thing, because I think you're exactly right. I don't think anybody would disagree that, you know, third grade reading levels are important to track. Head Start programs are important to fund and to have operating efficiently. Knowing it is one thing. Being able to move the dial.
Yeah.
Is another thing. How do you do that?
So that's
from
what
the office of mayor.
Yeah, so we start out with saying we're going to do social impact bonding around getting every 4-year-old in school, universal pre-K. The city of Baltimore can do that. You know, Governor Larry Hogan's not going to come here and say, don't do that. Folks in Garrett County are not going to come in Baltimore City and say, you can't do that. It's our money. So let's do it, right? So this is what I'm talking about, of us playing this game of ownership versus being accountable to our most precious asset and resources, which are our children.
Do you think Greg Thornton's doing a good job as the CEO and president of the Baltimore City Schools?
I think there's a lot of challenges with the school system. I think that, unfortunately, you know, when we look at this, like, charter school debacle, it's like, again, this is why
we're currently involved in a lawsuit over
John. Yeah. This is why we don't get ahead of these issues. We don't proactively think out these issues. And that's why we need the leadership and we need someone with their thumb on the pulse in City Hall to understand and know where the direction of school system is going. Charter schools are critically important. Now, at the end of the day, you know, I'm a huge proponent of traditional public school. You know, I was born and raised in Baltimore City, product of Baltimore City public school system. And a strong public school system is critical to our sustainability and growth as a city. But for us to get into this lawsuit with this charter school is an issue, I think, not necessarily on Thornton, but on City Hall. And under my administration, through the mayor's office of educational reform, these are the types of things that we'll be ahead of, that we'll be able to tackle, as opposed to allowing these issues to fester. I mean, how many times have we woken up in the past 20 years and opened up the sun and find out that the school system has a deficit? It's time for us to stop that. And it's not about ownership. It's about accountability.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Councilman from the 7th District in Baltimore, Nick Mosby. He is one of many people running for mayor. He is a Democrat on the ballot for April 26th in the primary for the city of Baltimore's mayoralty. You've answered questions about potential conflicts of interest on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
If you're the mayor and your wife is the state's attorney, well, she is the state's attorney. There are occasions, for example, right this second, Mrs. Mosby is currently investigating alleged wrongdoing by public housing employees who are overseen by the mayor's housing chief. The state's attorney's office may be called to represent to investigate the police department. They may be called to investigate people in your own office. You're a chief of staff. You are, you know, head of data collection. You're head of something. I mean, how does it work if you're the mayor and your wife is the state's attorney and that office is investigating an office that you control directly?
Yeah, first time I want to say I think that's a very fair question, and I think folks should continue to ask that question because it's important. When you look at, I think The Sun did it best. The editorial board, maybe about 2 months ago, did a story specifically on this after I announced that I was running for mayor. And they talked about, you know, political allies. They've talked about the role of government. They talked about relationships in the city of Baltimore. Look, there is no conflict of interest as it relates to me being the next mayor of Baltimore and Maryland being state's attorney. When you look at it from a charter perspective, from a budgetary perspective, you know, the state's attorney's budget is about a percentage of one a tenth of one percentage point of the overall city budget. It's been that way for quite some time. It will continue to be that way. The power in the city council.
It's still $32 million.
Yeah. But
it's a lot of money.
But it's the same money every year. So it's not like it's getting any benefit because I become mayor.
So even if there's any conflict of interest, are you limited in any way? For example, as I understand it, you're not commenting at all on the trials of the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray.
Well, I get a lot of comment on that.
If you're the mayor,
yeah.
I mean, are there things you're not going to be able to talk about or not going to be able to have a position on publicly because your wife is a prosecutor?
I don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you brought up something. You said, well, what if someone in my office needs to be investigated or indicted? We know that there's a state prosecutor, right? And, you know, when a former mayor was investigated, indicted, and ultimately convicted, it wasn't by the state's attorney's office.
Yeah, it was by Robert Rohrabaugh, who was the state prosecutor.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with Pat Gessamy or the state's attorney at the time. Mm-hmm. So, again, there is no conflict of interest. I would ask folks and employ folks to read the Sun editorial article that kind of spells it all out. I think that this election is about moving our city forward. And, you know, I fell in love with someone who's committed to reforming the criminal justice system, and I'm committed to being the best public servant and changing the trajectory of our city. And we can do that as a loving couple. And I think the citizens, the voters, are going to come out and they're going to vote for who's going to put the city of Baltimore in the best light. This election is not about Nick Mosby or Marilyn Mosby. This election has two choices, and that's business as usual and what we've seen in the past, or, you know, new ideas, new energy to put us on a new path.
That's a romantic night, you know. Light the candles, pour a glass of wine, and talk about the criminal justice system.
I wouldn't say that. I would say probably two slow ships passing in the middle of the night.
Yeah, exactly. You did not vote to offer a contract to the current police commissioner, Kevin Davis. What's your opinion about his job performance so far, and what would his job prospects be if you were elected mayor?
So first of all, that decision had nothing to do with his job performance, but everything to do with fiscal responsibility. You know, the fact that we put a golden parachute in a contract that the new mayor will be able to come in and kind of select their police commissioner just absolutely makes no sense. We've just paid, you know, Commissioner Batts close to $200,000 to put that in to a new contract was just the wrong thing to do from the administration. And I was very vocal about that. I think Commissioner Davis took over at a very trying time, not only in the city, but also in the department. I think he's done a great job of trying to mend and build relationships through the business community, through the clergy, in the communities, and even in increasing the morale of our police officers. So, you know, what we'll have to see is, you know, how do the statistics look? You know, what are we going to do as it relates to going after these violent repeat offenders in 2016 so we don't return back to 344 like we saw in 2015? I talk about this all the time. We talk about 344 folks that were murdered in our city. There aren't 344 murderers. It's this group of small group of violent repeat offenders that we have to develop a laser focused target on and rid them out of our communities. And that's what I look to partner with Commissioner Davis in doing.
Just this morning, the Sun is reporting a man named Victor Gerhard. He's a lieutenant in the Baltimore Police Department. He's the first vice president of the Fraternal Order of Police. He has been reassigned to building security and taken off the streets because of tweets that he's done on his personal Twitter account.
Yeah, he said me and Marilyn should be deported.
Yes, he should be deported. So let's guess here that he's voting for Mr. Trump. But yeah. It's that kind of attitude, that kind of manifestation of intolerance and bigotry that so many people point to when they point to problems with the police and police misconduct. And, of course, the trials of the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray are another manifestation of that. What does the mayor do to change the culture of the police department?
Well, first, we have to bridge in the community. I know that the mayor and the administration are looking to roll out body cameras a little faster now. But, you know, in my plan, we said in the first 100 days, we're going to have body cameras on every patrol officer. We're going to do away with non-disparagement agreements. And that's basically the gag order that if you are hurt or harmed by the police and the city provides some type of civil payment, you're no longer able to talk about that. Well, that's not correcting a problem. That's just kind of putting a Band-Aid and just pushing the problem to the side. We have to develop a way of connecting our community back to our police department. And then we have to drive more accountability in our police. I mean, that's completely unacceptable. And I think sometimes you have to take bold moves, even if it's unfortunately against contracts. But folks need to be fired. I mean, for you to go on and say disparaging remarks to a community that is there to trust you, it's really hard to create and grow that trust when you're allowed to operate and function.
There's a police contract coming up. What would you change in it?
Well, we constantly talk about the law enforcement bill of rights. We constantly talk about the importance of driving more equity there as it relates to us driving more transparency and accountability there. So huge proponent there. But also when we talk about the citizens review panel and showing that we pour more teeth there, again, providing more transparency and accountability into our police force. Look, most of our officers are good.
Let me just, because I want to get onto a number of other topics. You talk about true community policing.
Yes.
That's part of your plan. What does that mean?
So
what's different, in other words, about that approach to what we're doing now? Because we are already now targeting violent offenders. That's been going on for a long time.
Not effectively, right? And that goes back to data, that goes back to intelligence. But when we talk about community policing, right now when we say the word police, we automatically think of another word of enforcement. But that's not necessarily what a police is there to do. What we've done a horrible job of is providing enforcement and going after communities versus providing enforcement and going after the repeat offenders in those communities. That's what we have to do a better job of. But community policing is, the police is an asset to the community. So, you know, there's programs in like Philadelphia Rising, where the police officer is not only there to meet and greet folks, but he's also there to ensure that the city services are being provided throughout the entire community. Providing additional tools or assets to our police officers will benefit the relationship of those communities. And we've seen tremendous results throughout this country in Cincinnati and in Philadelphia. And that's the type of stuff that we're going to bring to Baltimore. It's not just about having someone walk up and down a block. It's not just having them patrol in their cars, but it's having them really be engaging and develop relationships with those communities. And that's real community policing.
Let's talk about taxes. When you ran for city council, you said that we had these outrageous property taxes and you were going to work to reduce the property tax rate in the city of Baltimore. How do you do that? Your plan calls for shifting some of the expenses from waste disposal away from the property tax category, I guess. Explain how you would approach reducing the property taxes in the city of Baltimore.
Well, a lot of times when we talk about property taxes, we talk about it from the standpoint of comparing us to our neighboring counties. But we're really comparing apples to oranges. So what we're talking about is having the removal and developing a waste removal fund to remove that out of that tax rate so we can start looking at it from apples to apples perspective. But then also developing different ways of increasing increasing traffic in our market. Right now, the economy is based off of supply and demand. We have plenty of supply, no demand. So what incentives is the city government going to put in place to drive that demand up? And I think the way we can do that is through tax incentives. And, you know, I'm going to have specific plans that's going to roll out to show folks exactly how we're going to cut taxes, not just for residential property, for even for non-residential property throughout the city of Baltimore.
All right. Well, Nick Moresby, that's all the time we have. We will have you back again and appreciate your time this morning.
And, you know, I have tons and tons more to say.
I guess that. And we will do our best to give you a chance to say that as the weeks continue throughout.
If I could say, the 15-point plan is on my website, mosbyformayor.com. Please download it.
We'll have a link. We'll have a link. Councilman Nick Moresby is a Democratic candidate for mayor of Baltimore City. We will continue our conversations with all the mayoral candidates and people seeking other offices in Maryland next Wednesday and every Wednesday leading up to the April 26th primary election. Next week, my guest will be Democratic candidate and businessman David Warnock. Tonight at 5:30, there'll be a forum of mayoral candidates at the Impact Hub at the Center Theater in Station North. If you can't make it in person, it will be live streamed. We've got a link for that on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's time now for our monthly feature, rather, that we call Smart Nutrition. Today, we're going to take a look at the latest dietary guidelines recommended by the federal government. Last February, a group of 14 food, nutrition, and medical experts on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee sent a report to the Department of Health and Human Services and the Agriculture Department with advice about what the final guidelines should be. Well, those final guidelines were released last month, and we thought it would be interesting to examine how many or how few of those recommendations made its way into the report. when the advisory committee issued its recommendations last year. We talked about it with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. She's back this morning to update us on what's in and what's out in what's known as the DGA, or the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Monica is a licensed nutritionist who blogs at Nutrition Over Easy, and whose weekly podcasts appear on quickanddirtytips.com. Hey, Monica, good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So, these food guidelines, I guess, are issued about every 5 years. A lot of people ignore it, but it is pretty important.
Yeah, most people couldn't tell you what was in the dietary guidelines, but they do touch our lives because they shape so many federal programs, everything from school lunch programs and what they need to do to be in compliance, and WIC programs, and SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance programs. So they have their fingers reaching into a lot of areas of American life, even though most people don't print out a copy and post it on their refrigerator.
Right. Is this related in any way to the food pyramid that people are familiar with sometimes?
Well, yeah, that's a public education campaign. And I don't know if you recall, a couple of years ago, we replaced the food pyramid with My Plate, you know, and these are campaigns to try to translate these guidelines into easy little graspable graphics or bywords that the consumer can use to make healthier choices. So we've left the pyramid behind. But yes, that's another example of a program that's kind of driven by these dietary guideline documents.
So about 10 months ago, one of our Smart Nutrition segments was taken up with this advisory committee about the dietary guidelines and what they were recommending.
Right.
So they make their recommendations to these departments, Agriculture and Health and Human Services, and there's a listening period, or there's a period of time where people can make public comments, right? So what's happened in between the time that the advisory panel made their recommendations and now with this final report?
A whole lot of horse trading has happened since last February. That public comment period is designed to allow people to weigh in after everybody's had a chance to read the report. But the people that are mostly weighing in are lobbyists, who are paid by various sectors of the food industry to try to dilute or remove any recommendations that seem to be contrary to their interests. So public comment, I'd have to put that in quotation marks. This is really a period of intense lobbying.
All right. So there are things like meat consumption or dairy consumption. The guidelines are not saying eat less meat.
Well,
although there are advisors on the advisory council who are saying just that, right?
That's exactly right. And when we talked about this last winter, that was one of the big headlines of the scientific advisory committee's report. They were actually coming out and saying, look, Americans need to eat less red meat. And they had several reasons that they felt that this would be better. One of them was because meat is not terribly sustainable. It has a pretty heavy impact on our environment. And, you know, we're all concerned about climate change. So they went out and said, look, we don't all have to be vegans, you know, but we really should be eating less red meat for the health of our bodies, but also for the health of the planet. Well, that didn't sit very well with industries who grow and sell meat, states for whom that is a huge portion of their income. You know, that was really threatening. And so a lot of lobbying went on. And indeed, when the dietary guidelines were released, that was excised. That recommendation did not make the final cut.
But they papered over it in a way, I guess. But they did make some recommendations about like saturated fat and stuff.
Yeah, they kind of coded it. You know, they made a nod to the recommendations, and instead of saying eat less red meat, they said, hey, we really need to limit our saturated fat. Now, if you're a nutritionist, you know that that's code for cut back on not only meat, but also butter and dairy products. And, you know, those are where we get a lot of our saturated fats from. But the average consumer doesn't go to the grocery store to buy saturated fat, you know. And so whether that actually translated into the intention of the scientific advisory board is questionable. And a lot of those scientists and their peers are up in arms over what happened.
All right. So the science, in a sense, was ignored, or at least put to the side in this final report. And the final report is issued by the Department of Agriculture.
Yep.
And you have blogged about this. Here's a department of the United States government whose mission is to advocate and promote and regulate the meat and dairy industry, among others, you know, under this the rubric of agriculture.
Is that the right department to be issuing dietary guidelines? Isn't there an inherent conflict there?
Indeed, there is an inherent conflict of interest because they are looking for ways to increase our consumption of these agricultural products. So what do we do when we have nutrition scientists coming in and saying, you know what our problem is? What part of our problem is that we're eating too much, fill in the blank? That does set up a rather intractable conflict of interest for them. So there's always a lot of, hand-wringing about, like, why is this the agency in charge of that? Unfortunately, I don't see any realistic, clear path to moving that project out of the USDA anytime soon.
Right. Talk about sustainability. It is unsustainable to move it from the USDA at the moment.
it's implausible.
Ain't going to happen. Right? Our nutrition diva Monica Reinagle joins me on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. Let's talk about the science behind the advisory board's initial report to the folks who published this thing. What was it solid? I mean, basically, what did they say? We've talked about the political reasons for it being scuttled, but was it scuttled in some way because of the science?
Well, that's what the lobbyists and those interests would like to suggest. Their lobbying campaign, both internally to lawmakers and also externally to the public, consisted a lot of trying to undermine the science that the advisory board had examined by bringing up studies that seemed to contradict the studies that had been cited to support these recommendations. But there's a dirty little secret in nutrition science, and that is you can find a study to support just about any point of view that you want to. And if you can't find one, you can design one that will produce a result that is confluent with your point of view. And so, a lobbyist can bring up a study and say, this study found that there was no relationship between beef consumption and whatever, heart disease. So, and they create this illusion of ambiguity. Now they're talking to politicians.
It's kind of like climate change, isn't it? It's very similar to that. You can create it. You can find a study to say anything. Yeah.
Right. And so it creates this illusion of ambiguity. And then maybe the lawmakers feel justified saying, like, hey, can we really, rely on them? Maybe we're not entirely clear. But what the Scientific Advisory Committee did to put together that report was a much different process. They're not looking for individual studies. They are really working very hard to look at the entire body of scientific literature, to take all of those contradictory results. And we have methodology for dealing with contradictory results and trying to sift through and seeing what emerges as true. So
unfortunately, it didn't emerge in this report, did it?
Yeah.
Well, we've got a copy or a link to a copy of the report on our website. Monica Reinagle, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva and my co-conspirator every month for our smart nutrition segments here on Maryland Morning. Monica blogs at Nutrition Over Easy, and she does a weekly podcast on quickanddirtytips.com. We've got a link to the dietary guidelines, as I said, on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up Friday on the program, Jenna Johnson joins us from Iowa. She's covering the Trump campaign for the Washington Post. We'll also talk presidential politics with Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins and E.R. Shipp, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's on the faculty of Morgan State University. I'm Tom Hall for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.